This podcast includes strong language, descriptions of war, and deals with issues of trauma and death.
If you're up against 2,000 fighters, we were down to 26 soldiers by then. That's roughly odds of 80 to 1. Come what may, we'll stay. We can't leave the village now. You know, you can't stir up a hornet's nest and then leave them to it, because they would have been massacred. They would have been slaughtered.
It was a close-run thing. I wasn't certain if they'd been beaten back or that the Pathfinders had been successful. I and the commanding officer of the parachute battalion was in the hands of some outstanding soldiers, and they didn't let us down.
What is it that drives people to be brave? To commit acts of heroism, often in the face of the enemy? I'm Darren Coventry, former soldier and now video and podcast producer at BFBS. I've been talking to men and women who've received the UK's highest military honours. We talk about what happened, what they thought at the time, and how they feel about it now. This is Tea and Medals.
Former paratrooper, Sergeant Steve Heaney, welcome to the show and the podcast.
Great, thank you very much.
So, how do you take your brew, Steve?
NATO.
NATO?
Yeah, we're milking two.
Yeah. So we've been kind of, that's always the first question, and it's always like trying to get what the standard is. But NATO is NATO standard, because yeah, that's how NATO everyone standard. Used to take it.
Yeah.
So, Steve, you're a boy soldier, a junior leader. And was that parachute regiment juniors that you were in, or were you in a more generic?
No. It was specific to the parachute regiment, yeah. Junior parachute company.
And where did you go for that?
So, I mean, I went to Purbright. So it moved to Purbright at the beginning of 1986. Prior to that, it was housed in the depot in Aldershot, and then they relocated it to the Guards depot.
How does that feel to go off at 16 years old and, you know, put on a uniform for your country?
Yeah. I felt in my mind that there was nothing else. I know it's a bizarre thing to say, but I really had a feeling that that was what I was meant to do, be in the army, in particular the parachute regiment. The Falklands had just happened. I was kind of taken on this emotional journey of watching these guys getting on board the ferries and the whole bunting and the country going crazy, and then them returning after what was a campaign that everybody in the world said we would never be able to accomplish. So I was wrapped up in the whole euphoria, and for me it was the start of a journey or an adventure, really. And possibly naively, I was thinking that it was going to be this real sort of journey through into the military and into the parachute regiment, and not really take on board what it was going to take physically to get there. So, but it was, I kind of went with some great anticipation, to be honest, when I eventually got on the train.
Steve completed his training as a junior soldier and continued as an adult recruit, ending up in the 3rd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, based in Aldershot. But Steve was ambitious and had his eye on bigger things.
Being in the battalion, I mean, it's like anything, you know, you see and you hear stories. So whether it's, you know, guys are leaving the battalion and going away on special forces selection, and some come back and some don't. So there's that whole mystique evolved around it about what do I do next? Where do I go? And I was one of these people that wanted more all the time, possibly just greedy. And I was thinking to myself, I'm too young to go on special forces selection, and what can I do? Where can I go? And then you see the Pathfinders at the time walking around the camps had a very distinctive DZ flash. So you're naturally drawn to that. And then you kind of ask around and you listen to guys, and I thought that would be, what an amazing place to be. I got wrapped up in that whole sort of, again, that romance of where next.
And DZ flashes, I guess nowadays they're quite common. They're called TRFs. But in those days, it was only 5 Airborne Brigade that wore that a coloured patch. So tell me what the Pathfinder platoon, what was their part in that?
It was a continuation of what happened during the war. So each of the divisions, the British Airborne, had a very distinct unit. And their job was to insert ahead of the main force and basically to set up what they had then, the Eureka beacons, to draw the aircraft onto the drop zones. So during the Second World War, it was probably, you know, 30 minutes to an hour before the main drops, then the Pathfinder company size at the time, would be dropped to secure those drop-in zones. I use the word secure loosely because you can't secure a vast amount of space.
But
to identify a point at which, you know, the aircraft could come onto. And then really it was to look for movement corridors, really, off the main drop zone and, you know, places where troops could mass and then move off quickly, consolidate themselves, organise themselves and then move on to their objectives. So that was really the role of the Pathfinders. And then to push ahead of the main force, again, looking at areas that could offer forming up points, areas where fire support could be located. So really the modern day Pathfinders is an extension of that role, you know, the securing of helicopter landing sites, the securing of drop zones to facilitate the dropping of troops or the inloading of combat power, as we call it.
I guess, like you say, there isn't that allure of something a little bit special, but what are the qualities that they look for in someone to go and do that job?
What they're looking for, very similar in a way to a point to exactly what, you know, special forces soldiers are. People who can work in small teams, isolated, with no access to really the main support that the rest of the brigade would get. So, you know, self-reliance, resilience, that ability to make decisions, to operate in areas of high intensity, to under incredible strain, austere conditions. So it is that whole self-reliance is what they're looking for. People who can get along, who can manage their emotions, control, you know, suppress their emotions to allow them to focus on the task, yeah.
Until 1999, the Pathfinders didn't officially exist. That same year, Steve saw active service in Kosovo, where his patrol were the first team to cross the border from Macedonia, spearheading NATO's forces. Around this time, there was a deteriorating security situation in the former British colony, Sierra Leone.
I'm General the Lord Richards. I was the Chief of Defence Staff. But back in 2000, I was a mere Brigadier David Richards, and I was what was known as Commander Joint Forces Headquarters. The JFHQ was 55 strong, was created in about 1997 alongside and a key part of the Joint Rapid Reaction Forces. We provided the very short notice command and control arrangements for the Joint Rapid Reaction Forces, or JRF. And so in that capacity, we found ourselves going off at very short notice to various exotic parts of the world, including the year before, twice to Sierra Leone in 1999, to East Timor, to the Congo, to Albania, doing all sorts of niche operations on the whole. And in May 2000, I found myself yet again on a Hercules with some people at very short notice to go and find out what was happening in Sierra Leone where things had yet again deteriorated. Sierra Leone had been beset by violence and violent disorder and corrupt leaders for about 10 years. The Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, was literally once again, twice before they'd been in this position, knocking on the doors of Freetown, the capital. There was a lot of panic. They murdered and mutilated a number of people. For those a bit older, they might remember arms being amputated, legs being amputated. I mean, they really were vicious, out-of-control thugs led by a man called Fode Sanko. Now, my role was to evacuate British nationals and other entitled persons, as the technical term is, and to get them out of Sierra Leone, and then to get out myself, along with my team. When we got there on May the 5th, 2000, we very quickly realised that if we did that, simply evacuated people and left, the country would implode and a lot of very innocent people's lives would be without doubt at risk. And so we decided to do a bit more than perhaps my orders really meant me to do.
Doing a bit more involved Steve and his platoon, who'd already been deployed to Freetown as part of that non-combatant evacuation operation, or NEO, being retasked. And the Pathfinders were happy to oblige.
So I think, in my opinion, what makes the British military, all of our, the three services, so great, and this sort of point that we punch above our weight, I think it comes down to a lot of things, training being one of them. But another thing is, and a lot of people brandish it about without really understanding its meaning, is mission command. This sort of decentralisation of decision-making to allow the person on the ground who's living it, who's got that truth, to make decisions in time and space that suit the intent, if you like. Whether it be a young private soldier immediately seeing something, all the way up to a brigadier at the time, making a decision that only he has eyes on. So again, for us on the ground, him making those decisions, and again, for us seeing, firsthand witnessing what had been going on, the AMP camps, they used to call them, these places where men, women and children of all ages were there with their limbs missing, arms missing, legs missing. This thing, the RUF, used to call it long sleeves or short sleeves. You had the choice. They gave you the choice. If they gave you a long sleeve, then they took your arm above the elbow. If they gave you a short sleeve, then they took it below the elbow. So what they'd done, this mutilation, and for us on the ground, everybody thinks, well, I'm in the army, I'm in the British Army, we're a force for good around the world, we've got to put an end to this. So I think in the eyes of everyone, it was, let's do everything that we can to put an end to this.
I got there and realised that if we left, having conducted a successful NEO, then the country would collapse. And I didn't want that, partly emotionally, partly because I knew we could do more, because basically the RUF were bullies. And my experience, as I'm sure many of those watching of bullies, is that if you give them a rap on the knuckles and make sure they realise you mean it, they will often collapse. And so I decided that we ought to at least give it a go. Problem was I had no orders to do so. And back in London, there were a number of people who were determined that we shouldn't, for political and I think sometimes for personal reasons. But I decided, and I was many thousands of miles from Britain, you do silly things, I suppose, that we should ignore the orders and construct an environment in which I could actually both conduct the NEO and at the same time try to stabilise the situation in Sierra Leone.
So going back to General Richards, Brigadier Richards at the time, the task force commander, he took the decision that the more early warning and the bloodier nose that we could inflict could halt their progress of the RUF. So the decision was made to deploy the Pathfinders, who at the time, we had 34 people in country, but obviously that was including our radio communicators and an element of support. So the idea was then to leave that detachment to work in Lungi Lol Airfield and to manage our deployment.
Beyond an illusion, it was a big risk. We would be totally dependent on a small organisation to be at the very heart of the plan that would effectively cause the RUF to cancel their plans to invade or get into Freetown and the airport. This was going to have to be a stunning and very obvious military defeat. And we were giving that role to a very small group of people, the Pathfinder Platoon. And Steve was the key guy within it. He was the platoon sergeant. So I remember meeting him subsequently and, finding he was confident but modest, as all the best soldiers I know usually are, with a twinkle in his eye and a sense of humour. But my goodness me, you knew you were in the presence of an outstanding soldier.
The platoon of 27 soldiers were flown 35 kilometres into the jungle by Chinook helicopter to stop the advance of 2,000 rebel fighters on the airfield.
So we were flown into the village of Lungi Lol, which was really the last trading post. So it was quite a large village on a crossroads, and had about 500 people in the village. As you would imagine, it was there was a few hardened shelters, but the rest was just, wooden framed, straw roofed huts, really. And the idea was to create a stop, if you like, a point at which we could report on movement and as you said, hold the village.
Yeah, so you said you knew they were coming, so I guess sometime they made it there and you just came kind of face to face.
Yeah, so we flew in and we got there on day one. And again, it was originally planned for 48 hours only. So we only had 48 hours worth of equipment. The anticipation then was that the NEO would be complete. So as I said, this was working concurrently to the NEO. So the extraction was well underway. People were being flown back to Senegal. So this was happening in tandem. It was anticipated that it would be 48 hours and then we would be flown back to the airport and retasked. So we went in and we set up what we would call temporary defensive positions, you know, got ourselves into the village, met with the local villagers, explained why we were going to be there. And we were quite fortunate in that when we got there, there was a platoon of Nigerian UN soldiers. They'd been a platoon, there was about 12. They'd been there for about 6 months. They'd never been visited. They'd never had any resupply. So they'd basically took their uniforms off. They'd married girls in the village and they were now living as villagers in the village. So we kind of announced our arrival and then set up this defensive position with a view to holding the village for 48 hours against whatever may come. Set up sort of checkpoints, control the movement, try to anticipate rebels moving through the village. That whole hearts and minds campaign. Local information will always be the best information because it's current and accurate. So that's, you know, that's what we did, set up a patrol pattern and kind of get this footprint in the village of the 27 of us that were there.
And tell us how it all kind of unfolds from there then.
So we spent those 48 hours in the village and again, trying to get a feel for life and anticipate movement. We were getting regular updates over the radio that villages were starting to be overrun by the IEF as they made the push towards the airfield. Their stated aim was to capture a British soldier. Everybody knew that. And then paraded across the media, you know, very similar to the sort of the Mogadishu in the US forces, the impact of British soldiers being captured, tortured, killed in front of, you know, in a West African country. So that was always on our mind. And we stayed there for those 48 hours. And again, at the end of that period, we were expecting to be extracted. And then the radio message came that we were to stay. And it was kind of open-ended that was it now. You're there until you're removed. What that does then, that generates a different kind of thought process. The mentality changes from small defensive temporary positions to long-term defensive positions that could hold off a major attack. It then requires a lot more thought on the ground, you know, the digging of substantive defensive positions, interlocking arcs and fire, clearing the ground in front of you, making it very difficult to sort of allow people to push into the village. What you've got to bear in mind is that is, you know, we didn't have a lot of food. Water, it was 40 degrees, 98% humidity, very difficult to work. In those environments, in the jungle, you've got to be drinking 10, 15 litres of water a day. We had two. You always keep one as an emergency. So one water bottle was never touched. You sip from the other. So the whole Hearts and Minds campaign was absolutely key. And through our relationship with the villager and that understanding, they then started to help us. So we've now got the ladies in the village walking to the river, this 2 kilometre round trip, bringing water, carrying, as you see, carrying water and demijohns on their head, strapped to their back. The village elder offered up a workforce of young boys and girls to go out and clear the jungle in front of us. Because what we had to do was ensure that there was enough of a gap, an area cleared, that if the rebels started pushing towards us, that we could basically put them down before they got anywhere near us. We didn't have a lot of ammunition. We had about 350 rounds a man. And when you talk about rates of fire, that's enough for a 10-minute firefight on rapid rate of fire. It's not a lot. If you're up against 2,000 fighters, we were down to 26 soldiers by then. That's roughly odds of 80 to 1. So you've got to put people down. We worked it out with 1 in 7 shots. So every 7th shot has got to be, you know, and that's the kind of brutality that you have to meet your opposition with. So it becomes a whole sort of back to the 18th, 19th century, creating man-made obstacles. They sharpened bamboo for us so we could create a field of punji sticks, an area where they would have to be out in the open and stalled, allowing us to be able to pick people off if they came. So they were out clearing with their knives, with their machetes. They were chopping it. You know, we were directing them on where to plant them. So it became a real joint effort with the village. And without the help, we wouldn't have been able to hold the village. There's no doubt about it. We wouldn't have been able to see off the first wave of attack, never mind push on through the night.
So now you're all prepared. You have been working with the villagers. You're as ready as you can be.
Yeah, so we got the ground to a point where we thought that we could mount a tenable defence. But again, obviously, you're relying on the fact that the limited amount of numbers that we had, we could only predict they would come one way, that the fear for us is that they encircled us, they enveloped us, and they came from us for the rear.
Like in all these close combat situations, at the end of the day, and this one reason the British Army, despite being much smaller than we would all wish, I still have great confidence in, is the leadership and inspiration provided by our NCOs. It's quite clear not every army has this. We do, and long may it last, because it means someone like me, not directly involved in the battle, can, with great confidence, give them really very difficult tasks and with every expectation that they can be met and will be met. If not, it won't be because of their fault. It'll be the general's fault. He's got his calculations and his analysis wrong. And so I knew, I was confident that we broadly had that right, but we still, at the end of the day, were dependent on a small group of people left by themselves in the middle of the night with very little external support to fight off a much, much bigger force of very brutal revolutionaries, the Revolutionary United Front, who were determined, because they weren't idiots, they knew how vital this position was, to attack them repeatedly using a huge amount of firepower. Well, Steve, along with the rest of his platoon, including his platoon officers and a Royal Marine that happened to find himself there, I remember, they did everything that I hoped and expected of them, plus much more.
We've now been in the jungle for 9 days. And again, as I said, we deployed with only our belt kit, a small day sack, a machete and our weaponry. You're in the same clothes. They're wet, they're dry. You know, we're sleeping on the jungle floor. We didn't have hammocks. We didn't have anything. So it's starting to take a toll on your body as well as your mind. You know, you're constantly on edge. You're constantly watching people. We've got hundreds and hundreds of people coming into the village because the rebels are creeping closer. So they're deserting their villages. They're now sleeping on the floor in the centre of this village. There's probably 1,000 people sleeping in the mud in the centre of this African village, feeling some sort of, I don't know, contentment that they're under the umbrella of the security that we're there. And again, it's talking to the guys and making sure that, because we all knew, we all signed up for it, but that, you know, when you're faced with what would have been insurmountable odds, you know, what happens if they get through those defences? What do we do? You know, you go through the whole hand-to-hand fighting, machetes, what happens when we run out of ammunition? We were told the QRF was on call. There would be a quick reaction force that would come from the airport. But again, that's 35 to 40 minutes flying time. It's 10, 15 minutes to get them up, get them on the aircraft and deploy. So whatever happens, we're fighting for an hour. That's the mentality.
So, yeah, I think, you know, we're probably at the stage now where the RUF have caught up to where you are at Lungi Loi.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're in the jungle now, you know, and I remember I'd come off stag, so we'd been, it was kind of midnight, I'd got back onto the floor and we were laid there, and I remember being woken up by the signaller. He pushed me away, he said, Steve, maximise. So maximise was the code word that we had within the platoon, that there was a rebel advance, or there was, everyone had to stand to. Everybody sleeps with their webbing on, so I was sleeping with my webbing on, but just pulled up, actually sleeping on my webbing as a pillow, but round with my strap still in. Sat up, clicked it on the position, grabbed my rifle, and almost instantly the shooting had started, the firing. And what it was, bizarre, is that the front sentry position had obviously had been watching the rebels, and what they'd done is they'd crawled up to the front trench in a ditch on the side of this, on the camber of this dirt track. So they'd started crawling up to a point when they'd got within 10 or 15 metres of the front sentry. And again, this comes into the rules of engagement. We were briefed as you cannot return fire until you're fired upon, basically. So the front sentry guy had watched this rebel kneel up and he'd basically tried to take a shot. And he'd fired one round and worried and in intent he'd got a stoppage. And then the rest had knelt up. So the soldier on the front, man in the front sentry position, then just opened fire. And then basically, all the firing had started. So everybody's up. Everyone had got the maximise. Everyone's waiting and watching. You know, it was, I think, 02:45 in the morning, I think. So it was still pitch black. You know, you're in the jungle. The jungle at night's a very, very noisy place from insects. The canopy, it's dark. It's very close quarters. The British Army hadn't fought in the jungle for 40 years up until that point. So, you know, everything's going through your mind. We knew we were low on ammunition. We didn't, you know, it can't be a free-for-all. You can't just be pulling the trigger at targets you think are there. So it's that whole ammunition management and kind of making sure that we're on control of the situation all the time while, you know, there's tracer tearing into the treetops. It's rattling around in the jungle and guys are firing their weapons back. You know, so it's that whole close quarter battle, that surge of adrenaline and looking and listening for people.
Talk of a QRF on standby. Did they manage to get the message to them to get them deployed to come to your assistance? Or
yeah, so the idea was that immediately as the firing began, if you like, the engagement began, I kind of went towards the headquarter trench. So we just had a hole in the ground. It was literally a hole. And I liaised with the ops warrant officer who was there at the time. And we had our very, very kind of quick face-to-face. And he started drafting the message back to Lungi to initiate the deployment of the QRF, if you like. So from that point, then I crawled forward. So again, you know, it's in the jungle. And I had a 51mm light mortar with me. We only had illumination rounds. There was no HE. It hadn't come into country. So I've just got these illumination rounds, which in essence is a large flare. But the thought was that if I could get far enough forward, we could use the mortar to create this umbrella of light. And if it's fired properly and if it's positioned correct, it kind of lights up the enemy while you remain in shadow. That means that they would be lit up, we would remain in darkness, and we would be able to identify targets a lot easier. But obviously, you can't fire the mortar under the canopy, so you've got to get out, which meant I had to get forward of the jungle and kind of almost be exposed in order to fire the mortar. So, yeah, just set off crawling forward. And at the time, we had a Royal Marine officer who'd come in. He'd been flown into the jungle that day. The idea being that the amphibious readiness group, who were on HMS Ocean offshore, were going to do a relief in place with one para. They were going to bring in some troops to replace us at the village. That was the idea. So he'd been flown in that day. So he was with me. So there was me and the captain from the Royal Marines, and we crawled forward. He was dragging the bag of ammunition. I had all the mortar rounds in a day sack. And we crawled forward to a point where we could use the mortar. Obviously, the guys are engaging the targets. It's still pitch black. You can see the muzzle flashes of the RUF weapons because you get that distinct flash that kind of illuminates their positions as well. So, yeah, we just crawled forward probably about 50 metres or so out into the open where we could fire the mortar from. And at that point, it's then just about controlling the battle. It's just about making sure that we're engaging targets. So, you know, soldiers are shooting at targets they can identify, that they can hit. It's about control of ammunition. It is about looking at the battle as it unfolds and then making any tactical decisions. You know, can we see movement off to the flanks? Do we need to move troops? Do we need to redirect our fire in particular areas? So it is that whole sort of understanding what's happening there and then in that space. So we just started firing the mortar round. So again, you know, difficult to fire from a prone position, so you've got to kneel up. As soon as you kneel up, you become a bullet magnet. Because again, when you fire a mortar, it just exudes this massive amount of smoke as the mortar round leaves the barrel. So you're just advertising the fact that you're there. And again, trying to direct the troops as fire. So that's what we did. You know, we were putting illumination rounds up. And once that illumination process began and the flare, you know, is up in the air, you can see better and then start directing the fire.
And then how long did that firefight go on for? You said it was 02:00 in the morning. When did it kind of wrap up and finish?
So after that first initial the volley, I kind of pushed back to the central area and said, we're going to have to go and mark the helicopter landing site. Now, there was nowhere for them to land. And again, because of the air crew, and they came from 7 Squadron, which was the Special Forces flight, they'll pretty much land anywhere they can, really, without endangering the aircraft, but almost endangering it. They're really sort of highly skilled. So I'd say on all, you know, it was kind of getting light. So maybe 2.5 hours, the whole kind of instance, we were stood to. And in that time, there was the initial engagement, then the quiet, then more rounds, and then quiet again. So it kind of was that whole sort of, you know, 2 hours, if you like, two and a bit hours, maybe.
And then what's it like when it's got, you know, calmed down and looking at each other, checking ammo? What, you know, what kind of situation were you guys in then? I guess
it was still dark, you know, so it's difficult. You can't move around the jungle at night. So again, lots of it's on the radio. And when the radios kind of don't work anymore, you're back to voice communications. And again, our frontage meant that you can pretty much shout to the other patrols. So again, it's just getting ammunition states. It's finding out if anybody's injured. It's disseminating ammunition again, looking at the areas where we think that it's going to be needed most. More ammunition to one place, guys re-bombing magazines, you know, that sort of adrenaline rush coming down again. But then again, kind of remaining focused and on point, because it is, you can hear them. They were in the jungle. They had this, they used to scream, and it was kind of an intimidation tactic that they would let people know that they're coming into the village by standing outside and screaming. So you had all these bizarre screamings coming out of the darkness in the jungle again to kind of intimidate you. So you can hear it all. So you've got that noise and then the jungle trying to return to tranquility, if you like. But then the noises of the jungle, the adrenaline, the wondering if the QRF is going to come in. Are they moving around the side of the jungle? So again, thinking about, let's push people to the back of the village. So it's all that whole sort of man management again.
And then when do you decide to go out on a patrol and clear those areas? When did that decision get made?
We knew we needed the QRF, so I called into the central area. I asked for one guy from every patrol to come in. So obviously leave the patrols fully manned where possible. One guy from each patrol to come in. So myself and 4 others, we then pushed back along the track leading out of the jungle about 100 metres to an area that was a little bit wider and waiting for the QRF helicopters to come in. So we were laid out of the jungle, the 5 of us, down the track for probably about half an hour. Again, just laid in the darkness, listening. A, if there's any movement in the jungle, and B, if the Chinooks are coming. As the kind of dawn broke, it was just the start to getting light. We heard the Chinook. We heard that sort of, that very distinct noise of the aircraft coming in. And then, you know, seeing that dark shadow coming in, and there's that sort of euphoria that there's probably 30 heavily armed paratroopers on the back of this aircraft. They're going to get off. They've got weaponry. We've got ammunition resupply. And then you're almost like, then bring it on. We're here. Let's mix it up if you want to, you know. So there's that euphoria. And then, you know, I'm watching the helicopter come in. It's, you can see the green of the pilot's face, you know, his NVGs on his face. And then they just come crashing in. The rotor blade's practically touching the edge of the canopy and it just comes smashing into the ground, you know, a tremendous feat of flying. And the expectation then, you know, because I'm facing the aircraft now, I can see the 2 pilots in the cockpit. I've got the guys spread around, we're laid on the all-round defence and we're watching, and I'm thinking it's going to take 10, 15 seconds for everyone to get off the back. The aircraft's going to fly away and we're left with the troops. And when it didn't happen, I kind of was laid in the dark, watching the aircraft, and I'm thinking they should have been off by now. And it didn't happen, so I kind of got up and I walked down the inside of the aircraft, well, down the side of the fuselage towards the back of the aircraft, walked around the back of the aircraft into the darkness of the aircraft, and the ramp was down to be met by the adjutant, one para, who again was an ex-PF officer, and, you know, the aircraft was empty, and we had the chat of me asking where was the QRF and him coming back with that. You know, the mission had just mutated then. The aid in Freetown was meant that, you know, the very small numbers were deployed. There was nobody to send. There was no QRF. And then it's that sort of realisation, well, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't get down in the mouth about it. So he explained that and I got off the helicopter and the helicopter took off and went back to the troops. We went back into the village and we briefed everybody up. And again, small unit tactics. What do you say to people that they're, you know, the QRF isn't coming? We're down to a smaller amount of ammunition. It is getting light, so the thought process then is that, well, we stand a far better chance if it's daylight. We can pick targets off easily. And units like the Pathfinders, specialist units, rely on that individual contribution. Everybody's in that unit because of their experience. It's not a, you will do this and that's the end of it. It's that sort of whole discussion. What do we do? What do you think? Everyone's got an opinion. So we did, and, you know, we asked the patrol commanders, and every one of them said, what do you think? We said, well, we're going to stay. Come what may, we'll stay. We can't leave the village now. You know, you can't stir up a hornet's nest and then leave them to it, because they would have been massacred. They would have been slaughtered.
And they didn't even bring you any ammo?
No.
That seems like a bit of a wasted opportunity.
Well, possibly. But again, it is what it is. Mm. And you've took the Queen's shilling. You get on with the job, and that's the end of it. Highly trained, highly competent people. People often say to me, why did you join the army? Why do you do this? And it is Queen and Country to an element, but then again, it's not. It's about the person to the left and right of you. And everyone stayed, so we took the decision to stay.
The problems we had getting reinforcements and support to the Pathfinders were pretty vexing. I did send a frigate up the estuary, and they got pretty close and were actually within gun range, because my biggest concern was that they needed artillery support. And we were under ridiculous orders not to deploy our own artillery from HMS Ocean, which had recently arrived. But the ship couldn't remain on station, so it had to withdraw back to the open sea, which meant the Pathfinders had no artillery support. I disobeyed my orders again and offloaded the guns and hid them in an old hangar on the airport. So at least we had that option. And then we had a quick reaction force that was our only real reserve. Don't forget, we had very few forces for what we were trying to do. But that QRF had to be deployed elsewhere to stave off a less serious but nevertheless credible threat that was only being handled by some quite inadequate UN troops in front of Freetown.
Meanwhile, as dawn broke over the village of Lungi Lol, it became clear that a civilian had been injured in the firefight.
A girl had been shot through the shoulder, so her mum had come screaming out of the huts. We told everybody through the village elder, if you hear firing, get on the floor in the hut and don't move. Because if you're running around in the village in the dark, we can't distinguish friend or foe in the dark. There's a chance that you'd probably get shot by us, so just stay in the hut. So she came out, she's screaming, and we sent the medic over to patch her up. And the medic was Brian Budd, who subsequently went on to get a posthumous VC.
Yeah.
So he was our medic. So Brian went over and patched her up and probably saved her life.
Eventually, the QRF came in with a resupply of ammunition and stayed for 24 hours. The Pathfinders mounted a fighting patrol with the aim of following the RUF into the jungle, but the rebels had vanished. The platoon then prepared for a second wave of attack, with reinforcements in the form of a mortar team from Wampara. But the RUF didn't attack again. After 15 days in the jungle, it was time to leave.
So then you've got this whole feeling of, well, we've been here for 15 days, you know, we've engaged the rebels, and it's that whole mentality of, you know, they can just sit off and wait. What would happen the minute they found there was no British soldiers in the village anymore, there was no resistance, would they come into the village? You know, this village had helped us, so they were open to whatever retribution that could be wreaked upon them, you know. So that whole sort of feeling is, we're leaving them, and what will happen to them when we go? So it's a very difficult sell. It's a very difficult sell to soldiers. You know, especially when we'd been there for such amount of time, you know, in a position where we could have been surrounded, we could have been overrun, we could have been captured. You just, you know, the sort of that whole mentality, that thought process was always there in your mind. And then now here we are getting on a helicopter and just leaving. It was a really difficult night, actually. Emotionally for soldiers as well, you know, to tell them the next morning to collapse their positions and get on board the helicopters. So again, everybody kind of coming out to watch us leave, and they're lining, you know, kids who we had played football with were lining the street to this dirt track, the sides of it, and wondering where we were going as the two helicopters landed and we got on board. And they're all stood staring up at the helicopter as we took off and left the village. It was quite a... Of all of the times in the military, for me, that was the most difficult experience, without a shadow of a doubt.
I mean, I don't like to think, and I'm not a sort of clever general, but it was a pretty average plan that required for its successful execution outstanding people. And whilst I'm not a clever general, I'm certainly a lucky general, because the Pathfinders and Steve Honey in particular were absolutely vital to its success, and they never looked back.
The platoon sustained no casualties during the operation, and Steve was awarded the Military Cross for his actions, becoming the first non-commissioned officer in the Pathfinder platoon to receive one.
So I was never told I'd been put in for award. And then I was actually at home one time, and the actual commander of the platoon at the time, who was the operations officer in one para during Sierra Leone, he then came back to the platoon. He phoned me up, and I was at home, and he said, I've just been to Colchester. I need to swing by your house on the way back to work. So he pulled up in a Land Rover outside the front of the house with two magnums of champagne. And I came into the house and I thought, very bizarre. And he gave me an envelope, and it had my name on the front. And I opened this envelope and it said it was from the Brigadier at the time, who was Sir Peter Wall. Congratulations, you know, in the operational honours list, you've been awarded the Military Cross. And again, that sort of that moment where you look at it, you read it. And yeah, it was just a kind of an amazing feeling, obviously. We popped the champagne, and he then told me that other members of the platoon had got gallantry awards. Yeah, it was absolutely surreal, bizarre, surreal, emotional, everything that you could imagine. So it was the Queen that gave me the medal, and, you know, and again, an amazing feeling when she asks you about it and, you know, talks to you. You have that engagement with her, you know, that very engaging engagement with her, and... You know, obviously she pins the medal on your chest, so it's, yeah, everything that you would imagine a feeling like that to be, it was, and more. I mean, yeah, it is personal recognition, but it's also a recommendation for the people on the ground at the time. You know, they're never, ever going to give away a number of gallantry medals, you know. And when you think that, you know, we were 26 people on the ground, and, you know, so we averaged, so 10% of the people on the ground got a gallantry medal or gallantry recognition, which is unheard of, really. It was a tremendous up for the platoon as well.
Well, I hope that Steve will have read the citation and he'll blush at the words we were using. It was actually written by his commanding officer, but I had to endorse it and tweaked it a little bit. I think the reason he so deserved it was because of his inspirational leadership. It wasn't just the raw courage he demonstrated that night, it was his leadership, the role he played in motivating and reassuring his subordinates, both by his example, but also, you know, in his care for them and understanding of the bigger picture. So that's why I felt, the rules having changed on the Military Cross, that he would be a more than worthy recipient of the Military Cross, because that always historically was awarded to officers, and it implied a very capable and effective leadership. And Steve not only demonstrated great courage, he also demonstrated great leadership. And I thought he would be the perfect recipient of this very important, a medal that people prize very much, even more so now that other ranks can get it.
An extract from Steve's citation reads, "Sergeant Heaney's quick reactions and his part in winning the firefight were crucial to the successful repulsion of the enemy attacks. With complete disregard for his own safety, he moved to a position from where he could put up accurate illumination for each enemy assault. His influence over the soldiers around him during the attack was considerable, displaying immense physical courage."
Tear Medals is written and produced by Darren Coventry and Josella Waldron, edited by Andy Prada, with sound design by Terry Wilson. Original music is by Will Farmer. Our executive producer is Alex Griffiths, with thanks to Steve Heaney MC and General the Lord Richards, GCB, CBE, DSO, DL.
I've got one more.
Oh.
Have you ever been back to Sierra Leone?
I've never been back. I would love to go back.
Maybe we'll go back, Steve.
Yeah, I would love to do just to go back and walk the village. And I mean, it's just bizarre because the majority of interactions were, you know, you've got the small kids playing football with you. I mean, they built the guys' beds, wooden beds out of bamboo. I mean, you've got like 7-year-old children with sticks digging holes in the ground and then wrapping, making bamboo and tying it up with rattan string. And, you know, and you think they're 7 or 8. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. I would love to have done it. I would love to go back and see what it's like.
Next series.
Yeah. Yeah. Tear Medal is on the road.
On the road, yeah. Absolutely.